Hi, I'm Jesse Hirsch. Welcome to the Future Herd. What keeps a system working when no one is actually in charge of the entire thing? That question runs quietly through this conversation with Barb Scott Cole, not as abstraction, but rather as lived experience. Because what she describes isn't agriculture as an industry, it's agriculture as a culture, one that once made participation feel natural, where learning was embedded in community, and where leadership emerged through doing rather than designation. There was a time when the system taught itself. Knowledge moved through relationships. People learned by showing up, by contributing, by being pulled into responsibility before they even felt ready. Institutions played a role, sure, but not as distant authorities. They worked because they were close to the ground, translating change into something people could actually use. What Barb helps us see is how much of that connective tissue has thinned. Today, we still invest in innovation, policy, and new technologies, but the harder problem sits underneath: how people make sense of change together. Without shared values, without spaces for informal learning, without trust built over time, even the best ideas struggle to take hold. This conversation is less about what agriculture produces and more about how it reproduces itself. How knowledge, capacity, and commitment move from one generation to the next. And what happens when that process becomes less visible, less intentional, or less effective? Because the future of agriculture won't be decided by technology alone. It will be shaped by whether we can rebuild the social systems that allow people to learn, adapt, and act together. Hi, Barb. Welcome to the Future Herd.
Hey, Jesse.
So the first question I love to throw out as our guests as a kind of Rorschach test on where they see things heading. What does the future mean to you?
Oh, I guess it's all the possibilities that are ahead. If you're a follower of brain theory or something, you know, the multiverse and all that, there's so many possible futures. But for those of us that don't live in a multi-dimension world, it's the choices that we make hopefully the choices we make to make the where we live a better place.
Right on. And I think that concept of the choices we make really create the world that we want to live in is something that we can kind of tap into our conversation today. And with most guests, I often go from the future question into a kind of personal question. But I want to make an exception today only because I want to indulge an interest of mine that I think is really relevant in terms of how we're talking about the podcast. And that's to ask you to take a moment to talk about 4-H. And, you know, 4-H is one of those organizations that I think for many people is kind of part of the fabric, part of the culture, something that's kind of taken for granted. Versus, I think for a lot of city people, they have no idea what 4-H is. And kind of when they hear about it, you really are blown away with the infrastructure that it provides, the culture that it enables, the programs that it's involved in. So I say this because you're the second guest that we've had on who is active in 4-H, and I don't think you're going to be the last. So if you wouldn't mind us taking a bit of a sidebar here at the beginning, perhaps to personalize it, how did you get involved in 4-H and what does it mean to you?
Okay, I got involved as a 12-year-old because my neighbor was the 4-H leader, and it's just what you did, right? That was, you know, there wasn't any ifs or buts, and I was an outdoors kid, and my parents told me that if I did some of the 4-H homemaking clubs, I didn't have to take home ec at school. So when I got to high school, so I'm thinking, well, that's a pretty sweet deal, and I stayed. I back in the day, And as soon as I came home from university, I was an Aggie at Guelph. And when I came home, my first 4-H leader says, well, I signed you up to lead with me. We're doing a club. And that was the choice and training I had to become a 4-H leader. And I've been doing it ever since. And no matter where I've lived in Ontario, because I grew up in southwestern Ontario in Kent County, and then married and moved to Renfrew. And so no matter where I've lived, I've always had a 4-H family with me. And so that's been really fun. My closest friends I've met through 4-H or through Junior Farmers. And because I think you have that shared value system, you stick together. So that's why it's been for me. Now, talking about 4-H itself, it's over 100 years old. It started in the States and came quickly to Canada afterwards. And they were clubs designed to make young people better at what they had to do. So there was a focus on livestock, improving livestock breeding, improving cropping, and understanding better ways and the new technologies that were coming aboard. And at that same time in the early 20th century, there was a real movement to make home economics was domestic science. It was like really looking at the science of being running a better household more efficiently and better food and food safety, the whole move to pasteurization and that sort of thing, and teaching those techniques to a group of people in an informal setting. And if you go back in the early 20th century, a lot of people never finished high school. They were lucky to get a few years of elementary school in. And so by having these small local groups where you could learn, because people passionately wanted to learn how to do things better and socialize as well, that I think that's why 4-H really took off in Ontario.
Well, and as an aside, my mom finished high school, and back then that was grade 11. So, you know, we think about high school differently now than it was in previous generations, I think, because there was more applied learning on the job and as part of work. But you said something there I kind of want to tease out, which is, you know, the model of leadership that is on the one hand kind of assumed, the way, you know, your leader is like, come on, you're leading this with me. But there's also a kind of invitation there, right? Where on the one hand, it's assumed that because you're part of the community, you're going to play a role in leadership. But on the other hand, it does feel like you had a hand, like someone was saying, hey, come get involved, come do this. Again, I think you take it for granted, but do you think that there is a value in that kind of each one teach one model where leadership is not just expected, it's encouraged. It's something that is facilitated and rewarded in that regard. And I'm raising it both at the risk of stating the self-evident, but I'm not sure that happens as often or as much as it needs to anymore.
I think you're right. My leader was someone who continues to be, she just turned 89 in February, and she's still active in her community, very, very involved, maybe not so much in 4-H anymore, but with a community project. And she acts as a historian and public relations. She's an absolute going concern. And so that, again, that was her personality that was driving, encouraging people to become leaders. But I also think, that really influenced me as well. And, you know, encouraging young people to take on roles in the community. I also was a high school teacher for 25 years and looked after student council. So I spent a lot of time walking the halls looking for kids that maybe didn't think they belonged on student council. But, you know, if they were leading other people astray, they probably had some strong skills that they could, if churned toward the good, right? And that ask and that noticing that somebody has potential, I think, is massive in, you know, not only community development and personal development, but also mental health as well. Just picking up on that.
And I very much want to talk about the work that you're doing now, both as a leader, but when it comes to cultivating leadership amongst young people. But let me throw a crazy a question at you, given, I think, the unique perspective you've had on how we serve our youth and how we support our youth. What have we gotten wrong? What have we been failing to do in the last couple of decades? And I say this as a very open-ended question, But the assumption here, and you're willing to challenge it if you disagree, but the assumption here is that we're not doing enough for young people these days. We're not giving them the kind of opportunities, to your very powerful point, to take someone who's very powerful at organizing kids to do the wrong thing and give them the kind of support and attention they need to turn that around and be a community builder in the way that we might have done that in the past.
I don't know that we did that in the past either. I think there have been people who've done that all along, you know, because I, you know, maybe wasn't the world's greatest student myself. So maybe I have a sneaking sympathy. I just happen to get good marks and get away with it. I think, though, and my own offspring have commented on it, when they first started playing sports, it was win or lose, right? You won a game, you lost a game. And then as they grew along, then it was like, well, we're not keeping score in this game, or we're not, you know, it doesn't matter. You're all winners. And that whole, and like, it's really good to learn how to lose. And kindness can happen when you lose. And so I learned how to lose in a really weird way. And this is a stupid story, but I'll tell it anyway. I was racing in a Sunday school picnic when I was 5 against the 9 and 10 year old boys, because I was a competitive little thing, no skill whatsoever. And I lost horribly, right? How am I going to be 9 and 10 year old boys when I'm 5? But I was going to run. I can remember my mom being so mad at me for doing that. But I can also remember one of the boys sharing his chocolate, one of the 9-year-olds sharing his chocolate bar with me because I tried. And it meant that he says, you're just little. That's why you didn't win. You know, and, you know, you start to think, okay, there are consequences. You can try, you can fail, and it's okay. And I'm really glad I had that experience to know that it's okay to fail. And you know, this is what you need to do next time, is maybe run with the 5-year-old girls. You know, you might have a better chance. Learning your place. And I think the same thing, I coached minor hockey and minor soccer for years. And it's okay to lose. What did you learn in this game? How did you get beat? What can you do better? And you have to frame it that way. And, you know, it's not all, oh, you were just wonderful out there. No, you actually passed to the wrong person. Or no, you didn't hustle back soon enough. You know, there's a reason why you fail. But you can change those reasons. You can change those to why you succeed. And I think for a lot of years we lost that. Because again, and I think it was out of kindness, not out of anything else. Because it hurts when you lose. And I think parents want to protect their kids from that. And you know, we became a culture where the participation ribbons, and I don't mind participation ribbons either. I think that's nice. You know, you came out, you get, you know, that's great. But again, expecting that and expecting accommodations for everything. We're not all going to be good at things. There's many things I'm terrible at. I keep trying, or I acknowledge I really can't do this. I need you to help me. Right. And that's part of the learning process, too, in creating community. And if you do something better than me, like I'm really missing my one student who would always fix my computer for me and my headphones if I was struggling. Right. But that was something that person could be very successful in and feel that, you know, I'm contributing. And I think by saying, oh, it's OK, it's all OK, we lost that ability of recognizing each other's strengths and weaknesses as well.
I think you've made a brilliant point, and I think you hit it right on the nose. And I'll use sort of two examples to illustrate that. We as a society tend to look at the innovation in the technology sector, the way that Silicon Valley has become a dominant industry, and their primary mantra is fail early and fail often. Right. And they've institutionalized the way in which they can approach innovation, not as a focus on success, but as a focus on failure as the requirement for success. And you're right about pain, that one of the privileges they tend to have is a lot of resources, right? A lot of money, a lot of staff. So when they say fail early, fail often, they are coming from a position of privilege. But the point is Exact. That we've created a society where we're averse to that kind of failure. We're averse to that kind of experimentation. And on a personal level, like some of the greatest times of my life were riding a bicycle. And I learned how to ride a bicycle without training wheels because my parents were like, no, kid, you got to crash. You got to wipe out. That's how you're going to learn. And I think we have lost that. I think that that is something that we need to kind of return. But you mentioned something that I want to use as a segue to talk about your current work now and your current focus, which I'll kind of extract as mentorship and guidance and the support necessary, as you were saying, so that when young people fail, when they struggle, when they are disconnected from, let's say, a path to their own success, what do we need to be doing? What are the environments? What are the structures? What are the events that allow us to create those environments that kids can fail, but feel that they have permission to do so, feel that they have encouragement to do so, feel that they have the wisdom to learn from those failures in a way that they may not be able to do on their own?
And I think it's having the right leadership, but I also think that it's the mindset of 4-H of learn to do by doing, right? Until you've tried something, you don't know. And like, I canoe and kayak a lot, but I've never had the opportunity to paddleboard until this summer. And I was on staff at 4-H camp. And so the kids were learning how to paddleboard. So in my supervision, I went down and said, oh, well, I'm going to learn too. And they think that that's funny that, you know, this elderly woman is coming down to go paddleboarding with a bunch of 14-year-olds. But, you know, after you get past the laughs and like, you know, I made the same mistakes that they did. But by the end of the afternoon, I was pretty good, right? It was a safe place. And, you know, everybody else is worried about what you're going to look like or, you know, what am I going to fall off? Am I going to be scared? Can I keep my balance? All of that's going through all of our heads. And when you're learning to do by doing it, it takes some of that pressure off because, yeah, there's going to be somebody who gets it the first time, right? There is. And the rest of us are in the middle. Right. And, you know, and the one person at the last, by the time we've all struggled through it, that person that's behind is like, let's give you a hand, buddy. We're going to bring you with. Right. Because we're all going to leave this. We're all going to leave the lake today knowing how to do this. And, you know, that environment where, yeah, it's going to be, you know, yeah, we're all kind of nervous because you don't want to look like a goof. We're all kind of nervous because it's a new skill. And if we can just create that safe space, but you know, it takes the right adult there too. The instructors at the camp were great. They just rolled with me rolling down with the kids, right? They were ones that are, you know, of course you're going to be able to do it. There was an expectation that everyone was going to be successful. And I don't think that happens in everything. And I think a lot of kids have it beat out of them pretty early that they're going to be successful because they didn't get it on the first try. And, I saw one kid explaining to another kid once, it says, well, it takes 10 tries. It's not just one. It takes 10. If you don't have it by 10, you know, then I'd worry about it. And, you know, and I thought, wow, that's pretty wise, you know, from an 8-year-old, that's actually genius. And I think if we have that attitude and adults working with kids have that attitude that, no, it's not going to happen on the first try. And like, don't be afraid to say, you know, I really messed up on this, you know, when I was learning it. But this is a trick I learned. Or my 8-year-old friend told me it took me 10 tries, right? All of those things are create that condition where it's safe to learn and it's safe to fail because, yeah. And it's safe to succeed too. And it's great if you can succeed on the first try, because what did you do to be able to do that? Can I ask you that question? You know, or are you just naturally talented and cool for that? Let's celebrate that because there's, you know, maybe you don't do something as well as I do. Well, so and I think that's the essential thing.
Well, and you bring up, I think, a really interesting point here, which I can articulate as a question that only an advanced leader such as yourself, I think, would be able to answer. And on the one hand, you kind of described how an 8-year-old is teaching us about statistical modeling. right? Because most of us know, we would think, okay, try once, it doesn't work. But they're like, no, statistical model, you gotta try it 10 times, you gotta get a base 10 decimal, right? The kid doesn't understand that.
19 times out of 20. Yeah.
Right. Like they don't know that they're doing statistical modeling, but they've internalized it. So here's the question. Given that you have spent most of your professional life in some way fostering leadership amongst young people, spending time amongst young people, in your current work, and this is an opportunity to talk about your current work, in your current work, what are young people teaching you? Because if the assumption is that as a leader, part of your leadership comes from learning from young people, then what are you learning from them these days, other than the headphones and the computer stuff?
Well, okay. I blame my headphones, not my skills. So many things, especially when you get kids by themselves and free. So yesterday afternoon, we had our STEM club meeting. So I lead with two other leaders, and we've been picking all the cool stuff in science that each of us like. And so yesterday was one of the leaders really is involved in plant propagation. That's her hobby. She makes cuttings of just about everything and has really a really great skill set on it. So like the other leader and I are sitting there taking notes like Matt. And so that we're learning from each other. But watching the kids, learning about nodes on plants and cambium tissue and, you know, why it would be important to keep knives clean. Like the questions they were asking were ones that were really insightful that, you know, I'm not expecting a 9-year-old to be asking about, you know, nodes on a plant, you know, and watching them again doing, we were doing part of the tomato sphere project. I don't know if you're aware of that, but some of the tomato seeds are sent into the space station and some stay here on Earth. And you grow them out to see if there's a difference between the germination. And it's a project that the Canadian Space Agency has been sponsoring for the last 25 years. And so one of the kids in our club is fascinated by space, plants not so much. But to watch the wheels turning, that plants in space was something that he hadn't thought about. And I think that's something that inspires me, is just watching openness to bring a new idea in. Because I think we tend to get really rigid, and learning from kids, the questions they ask and, you know, what they're thinking about and where they go next is like just a reminder to ourselves that we can't lose that. We can't channel that away and just say, oh yeah, well, you know, the Canadian Space Agency, yeah, blah, blah. No, it's like, cool, tomatoes in space, why tomatoes, why would you know,
how do we organize that? How do we take what you are kind of experiencing spontaneously via 4-H programming? How do we replicate that so that we have that wonder? We have that youth perspective, not just when it comes to learning and research, but all throughout the sector.
Oh, okay. Well, we had 3 leaders and 12 kids. So, you know, that, and the, I'll get too political, right? In 3 seconds, if I don't, but small classroom sizes are essential, you know, small groups of people and people that are really vested in youth's growth and development. I didn't know very few teachers that would rather have a smaller class and have more support in their classroom, because I'm meeting these kids for 2 hours every other weekend, and we have that special relationship. But a teacher has those kids in her class in front of her every day and knows them even more than which a lot of things. And I know, as a classroom teacher, I was a secondary science teacher, but those are my kids. And I knew who had breakfast, and I knew who had, you know, was struggling, and I knew who broke up with their boyfriend. And, you know, because kids tell you that. But when you have 36 in a classroom, and you're trying to deal with all that emotional background stuff and then teach how to balance chemical equations, you don't have that same one-on-one. And that's why the 4-H model is so valuable, because kids don't have that opportunity to work really closely with an adult that they trust. And you don't, and to have the time, you know, if I divided a 75-minute class up between 36, the kids would get 2 minutes each at the most, right? If I just talk to a kid. But if I have 2 hours where I only have, like, I've just got this little group of people, I can talk, I can interact. What do you think? Oh, careful with that knife. And, you know, it's better to cut, make your cutting this way. You know, we're planting these tomato seeds to have you make, you know, have you done that? I've got time to check. But if you're, we're mass producing a bunch of kids through a classroom, we don't have that time for that little bit of contact. And I think that if you were going to foster it, like when I look at small group success, it's so much higher than large groups, just simply because of the time factor.
Although you evoke something else with that ratio of like 3 adults and 12 kids, that we clearly need to have way more young people on the boards of agricultural organizations and in leadership positions in agri-food organizations, not so much because they will be there to provide the leadership, but to your point, to be outnumbered by young people is not a bad situation to be in when it comes to fostering leadership skills and the kind of responsibility we want these young people to take. With that said, I'd love to hear more about the camp that you were at recently and the other different programs that you kind of have a hand in or are participating in as part of the larger 4-H work that you're doing.
Well, I was at Future Leaders in Action Camp last week at Muskoka, and in Muskoka, and there was 36 senior 4-H members from across the province. We're gradually coming back in our numbers with our senior camps. We lost so many of the kids that would be senior members over COVID. The Youth Adventure Camp that'll be this summer is already filled with 100 kids. So we've got that group coming up, but right now we have just a small group of intermediate and senior members. But what a great bunch of kids. I was at the camp. Provincial Leadership Camp and Future Leaders in Action are two different senior programs, and they alternate years. So many of the kids that were there this year were also at PLC last year. And to see them grow in a year, what they have done in the year since we've seen them was just absolutely amazing. And you can see how much more confident speakers they were. One of the youngest ones who came planned the program one night and emceed the whole event. And it was like, you couldn't do that last summer. But now this is what you can do. So in the camp is really fun. The mornings are basic leadership training, from dealing with conflict, from understanding your own leadership style, to speaking, to SMART goals, you know, all the basic package of leadership skills. And then the afternoons, they were doing high rope challenges and hiking and learning how to build a fire with one match and all kinds of outdoors activities to burn off a little bit of energy, but also have fun and socialize, right? You've got to learn to work with people. And then the kids were responsible for planning the evening program for everything. So they had a chance to try out the skills they had learned each day and then provide a fun and an inclusive event for everybody in the afternoon. And they were great. If they had spare time, they were line dancing. So if that's the, you know, we weren't chasing them out of the bush. We weren't worried about anything. They were kids that were getting together and learning and happily hanging out with each other.
And a quick two-part follow-up, what is the age range that's quote-unquote senior? And what happens when they age out? Is there a lost opportunity in terms of them aging out? Or is it just an assumption that they then naturally become leaders of their communities and their workplaces and their organizations, depending where they fit within the broader sector and the broader society?
Well, the senior camps are for 15 to 21. Largely, I think the oldest one person at this camp had just turned 20, because it starts to run into conflict with post-secondary programs. You know, it runs through the, you know, the high school March break, not the reading week for most universities and colleges. So most of the kids are in grade 11 and 12 for, you know, reality, but you can go till you're 21. When they age out, like in my own association, we have two junior directors on the board that space is saved for two. They have to be 18 to be a junior director because of the legal obligations of a board structure. So we certainly, we've had youth directors for most of this century, for sure, ever since we made that a recommendation. And that's a good opportunity.
Is there anyone who fits that profile that we are not serving? Is there young people who are going through the 4-H process with tremendous potential, all sorts of, you know, go get them, but there isn't anywhere in the industry, there isn't anywhere in the governance structure, there isn't anywhere in the association for them. You know, is there a supply and demand problem here? And to what end do we need more young people ready to take on leadership positions, or do we need more leadership positions? Because there's lots of young people who are itching to get in there.
Well, I think in ag, there's, what, three jobs for every grad, at least three jobs waiting for every grad from an ag program. So I think there's a shortage of youth. Right now, I think we're starting to build up again post-COVID of having those youth that are available to take the positions that have come up through the 4-H program and understand. I think it's really important for associations to have a youth director or have a way that youth can participate. I know I was involved as a young person in plowman in my local Plowman's Association and things like that. And you know, there's junior cattlemen's and junior, but there are a lot of organizations, but I guess as farm numbers get lower, it's harder to fill it with kids. And if, and with the age of, you know, the average age of farmers being much closer to mine than my offspring, you know, where are they? You know, like I look at my, of, I have one niece who's got, has become really involved in ag, and she never thought about that as a career option until she took a job and loved it. You know, I have another niece that didn't study ag, but went into ag as well, because there was, you know, there was jobs and opportunities that were interesting. So I think it's a shortage of young people that come from farms. And then there's so many other possibilities of careers. So, you know, I don't know. I don't have a really good answer for you for that.
Let me ask what might be a naive question, but to your earlier evocation might be a political or controversial question. What about young people who aren't growing up on farms? What about young people who are stuck in one of our cities and would love to be able to find employment or entrepreneurial opportunity in the agri-food sector? Are there any 4-H chapters in Ontario cities or in Canadian cities? Are there any urban organizations or agricultural organizations that are targeting young people in cities, only because to go to our statistics, if it's 1 out of 100, 1 out of 1,000, 1 out of 100,000, might still be worth the effort.
Well, I think there's a couple answers. So 4-H Ontario just received a grant to study that, the feasibility of more urban 4-H programs, which I think is amazing, an amazing opportunity. I think we, the States has done it better than us with their land grant universities and, you know, having 4-H and Future Farmers of America involved in schools, embedded in schools. And we just don't have that here in Ontario. I also think that ag is not considered, in any way, shape, or form as a career option. I think it's not presented as anything anybody does. You know, it's just that old guy in his coveys, you know, and this is the International Year of Women in Agriculture, so, or Women Farmers. So I'm quite happy to be celebrating that one. And my beans are going to be better than your beans. So there. There, I think in ag, we tend to use jargon a lot. And I was at a conference some years back that was talking about the jobs in education. So this was for it was focused at high skills majors in agriculture and horticulture. And many of the speakers came back to it, you know, we're not doing a good sell job in this because we're agriculture and food. Actually, you know, what we're not just growing things because we grow things. We're growing things because people need to eat. And we need to be thinking more about careers that way. I don't think you're going to get crowds of people like I did who picked tomatoes and ho and worked in tobacco, you know, to put themselves through school. That ship's kind of sailed. You know, we do have technology. Like I love those tomato harvesters and thoughts as opposed to lugging those hampers. But you know, wow, what a job if you're interested in machinery, you know, what to design and maintain a tomato harvester. You know, we don't come at kids that way. You know, if you want to be a mechanic, well, you know, you're going to be working on, you know, the really exotic is if you're going to heavy equipment, but why not? Like, why aren't we focusing on farm equipment as a career? Or you're really interested in creating recipes and you know, you want to bring new tastes in. Well, that's part of the food industry. So maybe if you want better tasting lentils, maybe you'd be very interested in breeding lentils, you know, that are better for Ontario regions. But we don't. And again, this falls on the rushed speed that we have in the education system. That information's there to give to guidance teachers, but they don't even have time to read it and act on it. And there's not very many teachers with an ag background to even provide that insight in class. You know, I was always encouraging kids to think about farming and to think about careers in ag, you know, that they hadn't, but that's my background. That's my job. If I had come from any other background, I wouldn't have been talking about that. I would have been saying, you know, get into tech because, but I'm saying get into tech because, wow, to have sensors that can grade potatoes, you know, that's something that's going to impact me every day. So I think part of it is like when you're less than 2% of the population trying to convince other people to come and join you, and either you're seen as that idyllic pastoral setting or you're factory farming, there's not a lot in between and there's not a lot of listening. And in ag, we're very guilty of using our own jargon. You know, I used to say I was a cash cropper because I grow corn and soybeans, right? And that's what I do. And it makes perfect sense to me. But my daughter-in-law's parents say, well, how do you grow cash? You don't seem to be very rich. And, you know, and so now I say I grow corn and soybeans, right? I grow, you know, the corns for livestock feed, and I sell my soybeans to be crushed, or and sometimes they're exported for making tofu if I happen to grow an IP variety. And then I have to explain what IP is, and then I have to explain, you know, how the whole marketing system works. And so then people start to realize how complex the industry is, but it took a long time for me to clue in that I wasn't speaking the same language as the people I
Well,
was talking to. And
I think that's a really powerful metaphor that a lot is lost in translation. That we spend too much time talking amongst ourselves that we forget the necessity to translate our values, our understanding, our appreciation for agri-food. And to your larger point, I think As an aside, I would love to, if there is anyone at 4-H who is working on that urban piece, I would love to have them on the show, because I think what you are addressing here in the disconnect between how people perceive agriculture and agri-food and the legitimate opportunities that I think a wide range of people currently living in cities would absolutely love to be part of, they just don't have the secret handshake. Right. They don't know, you know, the kind of cultural connection. And this conversation is really reinforcing for me why 4-H is such an essential part of that cultural fabric, of that kind of leadership infrastructure. So I'm curious if, given your kind of experience as an educator, given your kind of direct and ongoing contact with young people, let us have our kind of blue sky moment here. If there were infinite resources, if there was infinite capacity, if the sector as a whole all came together and said, you know, Barb's really onto something, what would be the kind of programs? What would be the kind of initiatives? What would be the kind of policies that would help enable the kind of opportunities I think you and I are describing? And an obvious one, which I will say just to get out of the way, is yes, smaller class sizes, 100% right across the board. But I'm curious to hear what other ideas, what other concepts that you think could be catalytic, that could really allow for an actualization of the vision that you clearly have, that I think we would all benefit from in terms of allowing more organizations, more of the sector to operate in the manner we're describing, even if it's as simple as being surrounded by young people with crazy ideas.
Okay. My manifesto here. I think my personal belief is that everybody should be responsible for producing some of their own food. If you know what it takes to produce something, even if you have, you know, a pot of tomatoes on your balcony and you grow lettuce on your windowsill, I think that is the first step. And so if I had all the money in the world, I would have an outdoor classroom in every school with a growing area to start plants. I would absolutely do that and circle the curriculum around it, because it's real. It's hands-on. Kids, like the kids who left our meeting yesterday had dirt under their fingernails, and they were planting their own pizza yesterday. So they planted peppers, tomatoes, onions, basil, and oregano. And so they'll be able to put sauce on their own pizza eventually. And I think that's something that's really important. Any school that has had a garden and has had that thing has a better connection already. And, you know, studies across the world have indicated that, you know, when the kids are involved in their own food production, then they're, excuse me, much more interested in nutrition, and they're much more interested in eating healthy. You're more likely to eat a carrot you pulled out of the ground than one that came out of a bag of baby carrots. You know, just because you had that connection to it. And I think, again, in terms of the Indigenous worldview as well, like we're looking that we're all related, we're all relatives. So if we are contributing to producing our own food, we are also understanding what we are getting in return. And then we can start to understand, you know, how all my plant waste goes out to the chickens, right? And scraps go out there. And so they're contributing back because I'm feeding them, I get eggs, you know? And that sort of small scale farming, I think it's pretty doable for just about everybody. And to have it in a school setting and have that built in, yeah, the smaller classes would be great. And, you know, but that whole sense of responsibility, I think, you know, Victory Gardens back in the 40s and, you know, all that sort of thing, That was tremendous. You know, that generation really knew how to do things because they were doing it. Again, you know, like it's that learn to do by doing keeps sneaking in. And, you know, you can extend that, right, for food security. If you're growing stuff at school and then maybe you have a day where you're making pizza sauce and every kid takes a jar home, like every kid's going to be that much better fed. That's going to be something good. But those skills don't just come from nowhere. And so we almost need 4-H for grownups to reteach those skills that have been lost in, you know, in the 60, 70 years since they've been taught.
I would absolutely Sorry, just briefly, I just want to jump in and say I would absolutely love to see 4-H for adults the same way I would love to see 4-H in cities. Because to your point, there's a lot of people who just didn't have the chance when they were young people, and they would love to learn these skills and get access to this knowledge.
And, you know, maybe I'm falling into the algorithm of my social media, but it seems like there's a lot of people talking about that, too. You know, I'm always happily doing that. Behind the door here are my canning shelves. So like I don't buy a lot of things because I have potatoes in the basement and, you know, canned stuff in the cupboard. And so I think about it in a different way, and I've just always done it. But as I've gotten older, you know, it's like, well, why do I still choose to do this? Why, you know, am I not going to No Frills and just buying a can of spaghetti sauce? Why am I? Well, it's usually at about 11 o'clock at night of a day of cooking down tomatoes that I'm thinking this. But it's the day in February when I pull a can off the shelf and say, man, this is really good. You know, the peppers I grew this year were pretty darn, you know, flavorful, or damn, these pickles are okay. And not everybody has the luxury of doing that. You know, I'm lucky. I have the space, I have the garden, I have the skills. And it is almost a luxury now instead of a necessity. And like, so how do you do that? So if you're starting with the kids, which 4-H did right from the beginning, is teaching those skills to young people. If we start with the kids, maybe by next generation, we're going to have adults that are able to teach it and come back and help you with that, Jesse.
Well, I'm kind of blown away by the brilliance of the self-evident idea of having every school have a garden, or having every school have a kind of growing an agri-food program. Because, you know, maybe there are some schools where a greenhouse might make a little more sense than a garden, although I don't think they're mutually exclusive. But it's also a lab. Right. It's also an experimental space. Like, it's for learning. It's for experimenting. And I think because we've falsely thought of agriculture as something that is in history, not in the present, not in the future, we forget how central science and innovation is to the way we eat and the way we produce our food. So I think mandating a garden in every school, having community centers, having libraries have gardens, again, as a place for people to learn, as a place for people to get this knowledge, I think it's a brilliant idea, and one that really speaks to how we've lost the skills. I kind of shook my head when you said it's become a luxury instead of a necessity. I don't think so. I think it is a necessity. I think we have to return to thinking of it as a necessity, if only so that we eat better. Because I think, to your point, that food tastes better. Your tomato sauce is way better than the tomato sauce you'd get at the store, and probably more nutritional for you as well.
Well, I think so. But again, there's a lot of unteaching for people. Right, that it's too hard, it's too time consuming. You know, how many people sit down and eat a homemade meal every night? Yeah, you know, even I order, you know, even I'm quite happy to call Domino's and have a pizza. But we, you know, what's more important? You know, like, we have this perception that you know, our work and our activities are, but you know, you go back to Maslow's hierarchy of need, and you need food, shelter, and protection from the elements, you know. So food's the most important thing. And when you boil it down, food is the most important thing. So having that ability to know how to grow it, to know how to prepare it, probably should be our first goal, our primary goal. And I would put that in the science curriculum, 100%. Put that in the health curriculum. It belongs there. But we've just, because I think we have a culture of abundance, since we're that, food's always been there, that we don't even think about it as a necessity because we don't have to fight for it. It's been a long, cleaning up my mom's house, I found ration coupons, and it's been a long time.
Well, and I think we take for granted the systems we have now and the way in which certainly in my lifetime, we haven't had the Victory Garden as a necessity. It really has been something that is more a nice to have rather than a need to have. But the benefit of investing in the nice to haves is that when you need to have them, you already have them. So you already have that capacity and you already have that there.
No, that's true. But we're really short-sighted. Remembering COVID when there was a shortage of yeast and a shortage of flour, because that's the first time in decades anybody'd baked. And, things are missing from the shelves. And I think people are, it's tweaking in their minds that, maybe our food system isn't as secure as we think it is. And we're super lucky here in Canada. But, I think I bought cauliflower last week that was a product of Mexico when it normally had come from California. We're changing, and that what we thought once was secure and untouchable is not. And I worry that we're going to figure it out as a society too little too late. And, at least the kids the 12 kids that I was dealing with do know how to grow tomatoes now. So, there's that. I won't disclose the location where they are just in case tomatoes become incredibly valuable.
Well, and, to your point, part of the mandate of this podcast, part of the mission of this podcast is to make sure that it isn't too little too late, that we start to do what needs to be done now. We start to have the conversations we need to have now. And Barb, that's where you have absolutely succeeded and have fully demonstrated your bona fides as a leader within the sector. And I say that partly as a setup for my last question, which is the shout out part of the show, because I always feel that any good leader is always willing and ready to acknowledge other leaders who they think we should be connecting with. So it's meant to be spontaneous, but who comes to mind? Who are the people that you kind of pay attention to, that you look up to, that you think the rest of us should be similarly looking up?
I'm going to shout out my two 4-H leaders right now, Jennifer Dolman and Alyssa Peaver. They are both Aggie grads as well, but of different generations. So it's really fun to work with a recent grad and a semi-recent grad to do things. Jen's really involved with the Federation, and Alyssa works in ag business. So again, tremendous leadership. I'm going to shout out to Camden Lawrence and Tina Brandt for bringing 4-H back into FNAFO and supporting that in different communities. And they were tremendous. And I'm going to just shout out to, I'd like to shout out to my 4-H leader, to Marg Eberly, for asking me and taking the time to do that. Just to make sure she had succession planning on her brain long before I knew of that term. So I think that's really important. And there's so many really great people that I've met everywhere across the province that have neat ideas and are willing to share. And for you that are too many to name, shout out to all of you.
Right on. And, to that point, we'd love to have you back, only because I think we're just sort of scratching the surface. And you kind of evoke a sense in me that the leaders of the past were kind of demagogues who focused on ideology, versus the leaders of the future are pedagogues who love to teach and who not so much rely upon an ideology, but rely upon curiosity to better understand the world. And I kind of feel you've really embodied that in a really inspirational way. So before we end, any final thoughts, anything that we didn't talk about today that you would like to briefly mention before we end?
4-H has been my life. And you know, I have learned so much. I think I've received so much more than I've been able to give. And I think a lot of us who've been around, who are still here, despite our better impulses to retire, we just go because it's the kids. We just do it for the kids because they make us laugh, they make us happy, and it's all worthwhile that way. You know, it's having that connection, and that's why we keep doing it.
Right on. Thanks, Barb.
Hey, you're very welcome.
I think a great takeaway from today's episode is we need to look at the system differently. Not as a set of outputs to optimize, but as a network of people learning, coordinating, and carrying something forward together. Because that's what I think Barb teaches us, that the real infrastructure of agriculture isn't just land, equipment, or even policy. It's the relationships, and most importantly, the learning environments that make everything else possible. And these don't just manifest out of nowhere, and more importantly, they don't rebuild themselves. They require intention, spaces where people can show up, ask questions, take on responsibility, and grow into the roles they didn't expect. They require institutions that stay close to the ground and leadership that understands its role as connective, as empowering, not just telling people what to do. And that work is slower, less visible, maybe even less rewarding, certainly harder to measure. But it's also what determines whether anything sticks, whether we're going to make progress. So as you think about the future, whether you're a farmer, a policymaker, or someone just trying to shape the system, the question isn't what needs to change. It's how we create the conditions for people to make that change. To learn, to adapt, to really come together to make the kind of food that we as a society fundamentally need and deserve. And that's where the real work begins. Now, a quick note on theme songs. You'll notice the intro song today is the previous outro song, and I'm using a different outro song today. Part of this is me probing the copyright cops on the platform to see what detects us, but I'm also trying to evoke an ethic, a spirit, a vibe, so I'd love to hear what you think. Until next time, we'll see you in the future herd.